Welcome to Rob's Reliability Project, a podcast for reliability and maintenance people to learn, improve, and better themselves at work and at home. Here's your host, Rob Kalvaroski.
Hey guys, welcome back to Rob's Reliability Project. On this week's episode, I welcome on Rajiv Anand, the founder and CEO of Cortic.ai. During this episode, Rajiv explains different types of projects where artificial intelligence would be a great solution, how much data we need to get started, and answers some more listener questions. If you have any questions, business inquiries, or if you'd like to appear on the podcast, email me at robsreliabilityproject@gmail.com. If you haven't yet, subscribe to Rob's Reliability Project on your favorite podcast platform and follow Rob's Reliability Project on LinkedIn or Facebook. Now let's get into the interview with Rajiv Anand. Hey guys, I'm here today. I'm excited about this interview. As always, I'm here with Rajiv Anand, the CEO of Cortic. Rajiv, how are you?
I'm well, Robert. How are you?
I'm great. I'm excited to talk to you. I mean, you're one of the leading experts in AI and maintenance and reliability, so I'm excited to have you on today.
Oh, I don't know if I deserve compliments in those two areas. I don't think I'm an expert in either, but I've learned enough of both to be somewhat useful, I would say.
Useful is being modest. So I guess to kick us off, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? So how'd you get your start in maintenance and reliability?
Right. So I think I've said this in some conversations as I got involved with the reliability community. I still consider myself what I call myself a reliability immigrant, in that my background and my career did not start out in reliability and maintenance. My background is all process control and automation. I'm an instrumentation engineer by trade, and most of the work I'd done, pretty much most of my career, was related to process control and process automation. I started getting exposed to reliability and maintenance when I was part of the Emerson Process Management, Emerson Automation family, when Emerson launched the Plant 5 system. But reliability and maintenance at that point in time, to me, meant more the reliability and maintenance of the devices, like the instruments and the valves and what have you. But then when Emerson acquired CSI, that's when I really started getting exposed more to machinery health, vibration analysis. And then as Wi-Hart and wireless came about, and then Emerson had done an acquisition of a company called MRG, you might have heard of. So that's when actually it was from those MRG folks that I would say that I really started learning the real principles of reliability and maintenance from a true reliability practice point of view. So I don't have nearly as much depth as, you know, practitioners like yourselves, but I started learning that in the last 2-3 years, started, you know, joined the reliability community, and have learned, I'd say, more than hands-on practice. I haven't done as much as you guys have, but I learned from people like yourselves.
And no, it's fun. It's fun. And I guess kind of leading off to that, so you've been in the community for the last couple of years. Like, what led you to start a company focused on artificial intelligence in kind of reliability space?
So I think that's a two parts to that answer. So getting into the AI space was something that, like I said, I've been in automation. I have seen automation from the 3 to 15 PSI pneumatic controllers to 4 to 20 milliamps, and then HART and the field buses and that whole, you know, the R equivalent of the internet. So I've seen it go through all those aspects. And, you know, as people call industry 4.0, the industry 3.0 is what I had lived in for almost 30 years. And I see it as a natural evolution. So what made me jump into the AI space was, as I started following it, I noticed that most people I don't want to name any companies, but you know, most people or most companies who were coming into in this space, with a few exceptions, of course, were coming in as outsiders. By that, I mean, they were developing great AI and data science products, but when applying it to manufacturing, they didn't really understand the implications of industrial and manufacturing applications. So my journey in AI actually started out by, you know, as some of my customers were going through starting these digital transformation initiatives, and I talked to them and I said, well, how do you, would you apply it when it actually gets to your supply chain? You have to engage process control and automation people. So I saw a gap there. And I have always been, there's a technology geek hidden in me somewhere, that was the other part of it. I wanted to learn about this. I didn't want to miss this part of the automation evolution. So I thought if someone like me who comes from a manufacturing reliability process control background was to learn this space and apply it, we could do a much better job. So I saw it as an opportunity to learn, but also be part of this, you know, evolution, next evolution of automation. I had lived through all the previous ones. I didn't want to miss out on this one. And what led me to start the company myself was, you know, if I had to wait in the corporate world where I was, I wouldn't be able to do it as hands-on. So I had always wanted to do something off my own anyways. And there were some people in Silicon Valley who were encouraging me to, you know, come sort of join their world. And one thing led to another. That's how I ended up, you know, starting out in AI. I was fortunate in that I was able to just take a year off, took a sabbatical from my job, and was just able to go and learn. Spent about 6 months in Silicon Valley, was fortunate to, you know, work with some, you know, real legends in the AI space, you know, learned from them and saw, I was able to learn what we need to build, particularly for this community, that we could build something with a differentiator. We could build something that would be practical for, not for data scientists, but, you know, people like you, Rob, you know, who are practitioners. I felt that they're the ones who are going to solve the real problems, not the data scientists. So that's really what's the genesis of Cortic.ai is, you know, eventually AI will be just like a tool, and it's already getting there, a tool for any practitioner who knows their domain very well, and like reliability. So what I started out doing was, how do we build something which will make AI to be just another tool in their toolbox, so to speak, to solve these problems?
Yeah. And, you know, like, just to kind of take off what you said there, that's one of the things that I think you guys do as well, as is realizing that to solve the problems, it's not necessarily starting with purely a data science approach. It's starting with the equipment expertise and kind of using that to guide where you go.
And I think that's true for any application. It's, you know, I think for manufacturing, for reliability and maintenance, it's a little bit even more so. But in any vertical, in any field, if you're going to try to make AI useful, that's where AI is now, all right? Verticalization of AI is what's really going to make it valuable. Not the theoretical aspects. So it could be any discipline, any field that you're involved in. The real data science aspects will continue to become more and more automated, just like all other previous technologies you've seen evolve, right? That, you know, the programming aspects or the data science aspects, companies are already automating that. So that part will continue to get automated. And we also are automating a lot of that in the background. So I think that's when AI will really shine. And we're starting to see that happen. And that's when adoption will take off. I don't think it's something that needs to be pushed on people. People already, you know, practitioners, people who know the machines, they know what problems they need to solve. And once they recognize that I can solve those problems with AI, you don't have to be pushing for adoption. It will be a natural adoption.
So I guess that leads me to one of the first questions here is, why is AI better than like a static rule set or just having somebody look at it by themselves?
Right. So two parts to it, right? I would say in most cases that AI is better, right? So a lot of the AI applications that one can apply to first is, can it be equal to a human analyst, right? Not necessarily better, but can it do what a human analyst could do? And if that's the case, then what you have done is, you know, I ask people this question, no matter what type of data you analyze, you know, who wants to continually, repeatedly do the same thing over and over again to look at some data or some trends and come to conclusions? If it's so repetitive, why not have an algorithm? Think of it as, you know, instead of hiring a human assistant, you've hired an AI assistant to say, hey, you know, these are repeated analysis that we do all the time. Can you do them as well as I could so that I can move on to doing something, I don't want to say better, but can I move on to doing something more complex, more challenging? You know, I ask people this question, you know, if you're the head of a maintenance department or, you know, you are the director of reliability, I ask people this question to say, how many of you have more people, more human resources available to you than you need? Generally speaking, people don't have enough time in their days or enough resources allocated to them to be able to, you know, solve all the problems. So the first thing is the ones that are repeated analysis that a human does and can easily do, use AI as an assistant to do it for them. So that's the, it's not necessarily AI is better than a human, but it's an assistant. Let AI do that. That's, you know, it's, I don't want to say it's boring, but it's repetitive. The second one where you would say AI is better would be if you have to look at relationships between so many different variables, right? They could be variables related to the condition of the asset, the operation of the asset, the life cycle of the asset. You have to draw relationships. First of all, the number of relationships, typically, you know, they say a human can only analyze 4 or 5 variables at a time. So the relationships are complex, one. Number two, the nature of the relationships is dynamic. And by that, I mean, it's going to change depending on the context. So it's going to be different when you looked at it, but as this state of the operation, state of the machine changed, the relationships are not hardwired. They can change. That is something AI can absolutely do much better than a human can. That's just a fact. You know, dynamic multivariate relationships, you know, theoretically, could you say, is a human brain capable of solving them? Absolutely. But is it practical? No, it is not. So, you know, things that, two things, right? One is when we have problems and we go back to try and analyze them. So we look at them from a backwards historical look point of view. You could spend hours, you know, many man days to look through that data and come to that conclusion, right? AI can do that much faster than a human can. Secondly, AI can do that on a continuous basis as opposed to going into historical data and find the relationships. It's doing it on real-time basis. And the biggest one to me is the prediction part. I mean, the whole purpose of machine learning and AI is prognostics, right? Being able to forecast what's going to happen in the future, right? The reality is, you know, people who have deep domain expertise about one machine or one subject, if they continually monitor, if all they were doing was sitting in front of that machine and monitoring what was happening to it, you know, are they likely to tell that something is going to happen to that machine six months from now? The answer is yes, they would. But if that's all they did, and that is what I look at as a great application of AI, that if all of that's being monitored and it's able to, I prefer to use the term forecast as opposed to prediction. Prediction still somewhat implies that there are assumptions being made, whereas forecasting, say, is based on the facts that I'm looking at now and based on how historically things happen and based on what I know about this machine, particularly when you start combining it with first principle models, which are referred to as digital twins, you can get a really good forecast of what's going to happen in the future. To me, that is the real value. Sorry if that was a very long answer to your question, but those are the two aspects.
No, that was great. And I guess, so you've been working with a fair amount of customers and you've done a bunch of different types of projects. And I put out to the listeners an opportunity to ask some questions, and this kind of leads into it. And so Ali Reza Gudarzi asks, like, what types of uses do you see with AI across predictive maintenance? So if you want to just talk from your personal experience at Cortic, like, what kind of different applications are you using AI on?
You know, without being specific to a machine, right, if I was to talk in general terms, based on the type of problems we've solved, very few of them have been focused on using condition data. So that's you know, something else that I think sometimes misunderstood. So by that, what I mean is there are very few problems where we've simply used condition data like vibration or ultrasonic by itself. The type of problems that we've been able to solve in a practical way are where we can use that condition data and apply it with the process data or the operating data of the machine, right? And being able to extend the coverage that one can provide with predictive maintenance. By that I mean, like, there are failure modes that you could go after with just pure condition monitoring like vibration. But if you combine that now with the electrical data or the process data, we've been able to provide coverage for failure modes, which was not otherwise possible. That's one. The other one, which has been really exciting, both for us and for our customers, is doing predictions without using any traditional condition data. So looking at the electrical behavior, for example, of let's say a vacuum pump, being able to develop a model which simply looks at the transient behavior. So, you know, every time that pump starts, I think we all understand that concept, that the behavior of the inrush current and how it's going to behave during the startup, producing the startup torque. If we've been able to model its performance over multiple starts, from that data itself, we've been able to create true early warning before the condition sensors could ever have picked it up. I mean, in terms of weeks or months ahead. Now, one thing to keep in mind is that type of early warning may not have the precision in that it may not be able to say that the problem is with the bearing or the problem is with this part of the motor, but it gave you a much earlier warning. So some of the customers that we are working with, what they've been able to do by using that early warning is, even if they had manual data collection on it or route-based data collection on it, that early warning is used for them to change their monitoring periods. So you can even make a route-based program much more effective by using early warnings, which were given to you not from a condition sensor, but from just the behavior of the machine, you know, how it was behaving from an electrical perspective, how it was behaving from a process perspective. Those we found to be the most valuable and exciting applications.
Yeah, no, that sounds really interesting. And also, like, that's one of the things that you guys have talked about at a few conferences was that, you know, you don't need to go out and buy sensors. A lot of the data that your plant currently tracks can be used to, like, to apply AI to detect, you know, failures or to forecast failures.
Right. And I think it starts to put, you know, I know the true reliability practitioners understand that, and sometimes they're constantly trying others in their organizations to understand that they're not a maintenance function, right? The reliability is a function that's truly providing you, operational certainty or operational, an indication of the overall operational behavior of the asset, right? That has nothing to do with maintenance, right? So the other thing it does is you end up engaging reliability and operations knowledge, and therefore bringing those two functions together. And it's not the same as operator-driven reliability, but the point here is you have to focus more on, you truly have to understand, one is not at a component level, but at a system level behavior, right? Those are some of the reliability principles that we know to be the right ones, but AI, I don't want to say forces you to apply them, but if you start applying them, then you make AI really valuable. So I would say, a reliability practitioner or a maintenance practitioner or a machinery analyst who will succeed in the new world with AI and machine learning will be the one who is able to take a system level approach and truly understands the operating behavior of that asset. They're the ones who will be more successful in solving problems.
I really like that. No, I think that you're right. I mean, there's also, like, the other thing that's nice about taking that type of approach is you will get, as kind of a side effect of that, is you'll get cultural buy-in, which I think is super important in having these AI projects succeed.
Mm-hmm.
So the next question I've gotten, and I've gotten it at multiple different conferences from a bunch of different people, is how much data do we need to get started?
It depends on the technique you're going to use, right? And it depends on the problem you're trying to solve. But in general, let me put this out there as a general principle that more data will beat a really clever algorithm any day. That's a given. People are working on technologies which can work better with less data, but that principle generally applies. So answering the question, how much data, I don't think it can be answered in terms of the duration or the size in megabytes or gigabytes, right? What I try to go for is, if you're trying to solve a particular problem, let's say if you're trying to predict a particular variable, or if you're trying to do anomaly detection of a fault or a fault prediction, the model needs to be able to have seen the behavior of those variables under all possible circumstances, right? Which means that, let's say, if you only had 6 months worth of data, but that 6 months worth of data represents, you know, all the, you know, startup, transient behavior, full load, you know, different load conditions, and it has potentially seen some abnormal behavior within that data set, that 6 months worth of data is good. Now, you could say, I have 6 months worth of data for the same asset, but in those 6 months, things didn't change much. Well, that same 6 months of data is going to be much less useful than the previous 6 months that I talked about. One thing one really key principle that I've learned is, see, any good AI or any machine learning model is going to be developed well if the data that you gave it had variance in it. And it's kind of counterintuitive, right? Because a lot of the times, what we are trying to do is we're trying to reduce variance, right? If I give a model 6 years worth of data, right, or 60 years worth of data, right, but within that, there was very little variance on a model. They were pretty close to flat lines. There's nothing to learn from it. It's no different than humans. If all you do is you see the same thing over and over again, you're limited. Your knowledge is limited to that. So in answering, you know, how much data, it's more about what is in that data. So is there any knowledge in that data? Is there anything to be learned from that data? Knowledge and learning from data comes from how much variance it has in it. So that's a way to go about deciding how much data you need, right? So it's not the quantity. It's, does that data actually have information from which the model can learn? And information, again, I'm repeating myself, perhaps repeating, is information is encoded in the data in the form of variance. You got to find that.
No, that's a great point. And it's something that I don't think a lot of people think about. They just want an answer like, oh, it's 6 months or a year or whatever. But really, if you're trying to train a model on a failure, like on 10 different failure modes, but you only show it 5, you can't expect it to understand the other 5.
Right. Exactly.
Now, something that you did mention at the MainTrain conference was that you guys are working on like a failure simulator. Do you want to give us a little intro on what that is?
Yeah. In fact, we are doing the second iteration of that now. We have, we're fortunate to get a couple of really good researchers working with us on that now. So without giving away too much, because we still don't have the patent. So machine learning models generally are used to, they've been trained on data and they get new data and they tell you something. Those in your audience who understand machine learning a little bit more would know about the concept of generative models, or you can look it up. So this is where you can use machine learning to generate an output. So fundamentally, that's really what we're doing. So, you know, use generative models who the models have seen the data. They may not, the model has not seen a lot of past failures or anomalies, but it was given enough data to understand the behavior of the basic variables and features. That knowledge can be used to make it generate what would be anomalous patterns. Right now, the key here is, you know, if I was to show you something anomalous, so you don't have a lot of labeled failures to give me, but if I was to show you a pattern of those variables, if you knew that machine and that problem, you'll be able to say, yeah, this looks abnormal, right? Now, that's a simpler part. But what is the likelihood of that abnormality actually happening on the asset? That you can learn from that data, and that's really where we're putting in that secret sauce to present to you patterns which you'll be able to tell that they're anomalous, but they actually are likely to happen. That makes sense?
Absolutely. And you're using those failure kind of simulations to train your other models that are detecting them, right?
Right. So this is to speed up the process. You know, most, once again, I don't mean to point out to anybody's approach as being good or bad. You know, people who don't come from the manufacturing world, who have great data science technology and capabilities, will come into a manufacturing application and say, do you have a lot of failure and anomaly data? If you do, I can, you know, train the models. You know, unlike doing an AI application for, let's say, the stock market or something else, or insurance or credit card fraud, et cetera, where finding anomalies happen a lot. They happen every day, right? In manufacturing, in industrial applications, we don't have that, right? It's not that failures happen every day or frequently because you know, nobody's running their equipment that poorly or badly. And secondly, failures and anomalies are in industrial and manufacturing applications are very expensive, right? So someone's not simply going to generate them. You know, an OEM could probably generate some of that in a lab setting. And reality is you could use digital twins to do that. But when you're talking about physical behavior, when you're talking about, you know, not just process dynamics, but the physical behavior of the equipment and many things that could impact it, it's not that easy. So the whole idea of that simulator is to get people started quicker to be able to build and train models without a lot of past failure and anomaly data. So we're really excited about it. So we're just finishing version 2 of that. We've made it a little bit better than our first release was.
Awesome. No, like if you ever release version 2, let me know. We can put it out there so everyone knows about it.
Yeah. So we're hoping to release that in March.
Awesome. So I guess, you know, kind of stepping off that, Lucas Marino asks, what do you think are kind of the biggest hurdles to having a successful implementation of an AI project?
I think not defining and designing the problem well, not understanding the equipment and the equipment problems and the equipment behavior. That's a hurdle. And the other still is, and I don't mean to talk about it from a hype point of view, there is a lot of hype conversation about the IT, OT convergence, etc. But there is some reality to that. And that has more to do with how data has been treated in the past. You know, I've worked with the most sophisticated organizations who thought they were doing a great job of data collection. Therefore, they thought they'd be very well set to do this. We have never had to look at data from this perspective. So, you know, if someone is planning to implement this in the future or even in the near term, before you go down the path of AI, look at two things. You know, one is the data that you have, take a closer look at it. See, is it as good as you think it is? Chances are it won't be in most cases. That's one. And the second is problem or solution design, which has nothing to do with data science, has nothing to do with AI. It has everything to do with reliability fundamentals. You know, the other thing I say is AI can be used to solve a lot of problems, but should you use it everywhere? What is the right application? It's so you should first review it and say, I'm not going to try and use AI as a band-aid to a problem that should be solved through other means. So very classic example that everybody uses as an application of AI or pattern recognition is, you know, detecting cavitation. Yes, sometimes you do have to put something in to detect cavitation, but you know, if you're going to spend X amount of money to do cavitation detection, could that have been spent better on eliminating the causes of cavitation? Is there something fundamentally wrong with your piping geometry and your flow that should be corrected rather than, you know, using AI to build a cavitation detector? So a lot of those fundamentals and basics to say, this problem cannot be solved with traditional techniques. And therefore, we should apply AI to it. And then looking at, do we have the data for it? Because I've seen, give you some examples of where I've seen the failures is you started out with what you thought you were beginning, starting an AI project, but it ended up turning into a sensor project because you didn't have the data. And, you know, unless you're dealing with some really high speed, high cycle time equipment, you know, you might need to wait a year to get data from those sensors to do your AI. So then are you really doing AI project? Are you really able to demonstrate the AI value to your organization? So, you know, start with those where you understand the problem, and you may not have all the data, but you have most of the data.
Perfect. I guess that leads me to the next question. So Stephen Perrier asks, how do you validate the raw input data?
I think what the question being asked here is, does that data represent the actual state of the equipment? That is, you know, so the way data scientists will perform, the first function they'll perform on the data would be a technique called EDA, exploratory data analysis. What you're looking for is, you know, are the distribution of data, granularity of data, is it consistent? Does it actually represent what the model is likely to see in the future? If I understood the question correctly. So what you're looking at is, you don't want to be training your models on noise, because if you've trained it on noise, then it's really not going to be useful to look at the baseline behavior and tell you what is abnormal, right? I'm not sure if I addressed that correctly, but what you're looking for is the data that's going to become features into the model. You know, is it consistent? Does it represent you know, the distributions that actually happened during the process? You know, did I give you an example? Let's say you were working on a chiller and all the data that you gave it was from the winter time, right? You know, 2/3 of the data is the winter time data when the chiller doesn't work that much or at all. So does it represent what will likely happen to those variables? That's probably a key principle to use. So if I didn't understand the question correctly, I'd be happy to follow up. It's making sure that you're not building a model on noise, and you're not building a model on something that is not likely to represent the real behavior of that equipment in a facility.
Yeah, I think you understood the question correctly, but obviously, like, you're happy to answer questions. So I guess that leads me to, like, we'll wrap up here. So where can people find you? Where can people find Cortic.ai? Give us kind of, you know, some plugs here.
Our website, of course, www.cortic.ai. LinkedIn, we do try to follow us. If you follow us on LinkedIn, we do try to share some knowledge there as well. And I'm happy to take as many questions from your community. You can simply go to write to info@cortic.ai, and those questions will end up with one of the experts. And we are, Rob, you know this, you know, we believe that the more educated people are, the better choices they will make. So we're always happy to do, you know, a little bit more personalized you know, 1 hour, 2 hour type of trainings. We will be putting on some of the training that we've been doing at, you know, the IMC and the reliability conference, et cetera. We're going to try to convert those into 1 hour modules so people can consume them at their own time and pace. Hope to have that released on our website by the end of this quarter, towards March.
Perfect. Yeah, those are, I mean, I was at the one at the reliability conference. It was great. And definitely, like, people, when those are released, definitely jump on those, because I think there's a lot of valuable information there. I guess, Rajiv, are you going to be at any conferences coming up here in 2019?
So we will obviously will be at the Reliability Conference in May. I believe, is that in Vegas or Seattle? Seattle this year, I think. Actually, we are also doing a full-day workshop. Like the previous workshops we've done have been four-hour workshops. We're doing a full-day workshop at the Reliability Center at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, in March. So people who are attending that March conference, we have a full-day workshop happening there. Those who are in the Reliability Leadership Institute would generally be at most of the RLI meetings as well.
Perfect. Yeah, I mean, I see you guys seems to be every conference, so you're everywhere. Awesome. So, you know, Rajiv, I want to thank you for coming on. I mean, I think that there was some great, you know, we touched on some great stuff here, and I think that people are going to definitely, you know, have some, at least some thought-provoking questions. And I mean, if you want to reach out, obviously info@cortec.ai, you can email and get your questions answered there. You can, or you can, you know, ask me on LinkedIn, or you can email robsreliabilityproject@gmail.com. And, you know, we can have another episode where Rajiv comes back on to answer some more questions.
Thank you, Rob.
No, I appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule.
It's a pleasure.
Perfect. So everyone who's still listening, you know, I appreciate you listening so much. You know, if you haven't yet subscribed to Rob's Reliability Project on your favorite podcast platform, thank you, Rajiv, and we'll see you all next week.
Great. Thank you, Robin. Dribbling a bottle of shapes in the sand, looking through an illusion with the sun shining in my hand, the sun shining in my hand. In the holes in the sky, cosmic embrace, melting into a portrait of size, a portrait of size.